than the rest of it, I'm delighted. Dr. Roy, I do thank you.
You're welcome, Wesley.
Thank you. Once again, I am Roy, AC2GS. I probably haven't ID'd myself enough. And I am the control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. You're here every Sunday night from 8 until about 11. We have another 10 minutes before Space Report is due, unless no one has any other questions or comments. So I will ask if anyone has any questions or comments that they would like to mention at this time.
AC2PM.
Yes, Jeff.
What's the application of the Mobius to ham radio?
I do not have the faintest idea. I am willing to bet that there's some guy someplace who's tried to build a Mobius strip antenna. Matter of fact, I'd be willing to bet that if you go through enough April issues of QST, there will be one someplace.
Early on, I bet. AC2PO, I'll be listening, hoping to hear some space reports.
One more thing, just to worry about the antenna.
Once again, scientific nature, please give me your call sign and your name.
Dr. Roy, but Mobius is absolutely amazing structure for an antenna. Then look at the polarity you could create with that matrix.
I would be curious of the best way of implementing a feed point to it.
Fractals.
You have a fractal antenna, and you have no problem with feeding them. Now you have a Mobius.
Okay, I think they're diametrically opposed. I don't think you could have a Mobius fractal. Fractals are significantly different topologically.
I have to think about it, but I don't believe there is a problem with it.
Okay, I will ponder it. Let me tell you guys, I will read you one of my science talk articles that's way timely. If I don't do it tonight, it probably is not going to be told. So I will drop for a second. I will give you a science talk, and then we will then move on to Paul and the space report.
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
Well, my battery's back a little bit anyway. I had a quick question for you. It's just a general ham radio question. It might make everyone laugh except me, and it has to do with soldering versus hot glue.
Okay. All things considered, I would probably vote for solder, but tell us the story.
No. It's very easy to spill solder over into another connection that you don't want soldered. Or if you're just twisting two wires together, let's say any wires, is there anything? Yes, of course, solder is preferable. But is there anything wrong chemically with connecting two conductors?
Well, it depends upon the material in the glue, I guess. If there's any acidic compound, or if it breaks down to any acidic compound, you might experience corrosion in the wiring, and that's probably not a good thing. For the most part, I'm a big fan of either crimping or of soldering. You want to have a nice conductive metal mesh with your wires, if at all possible. The only thing that glue at best will give you is mechanical strength. It won't give you any kind of electrical stability. So if you suck and that's all you got, I guess, whatever. But again, there's too many possibilities of too many glues have too many other materials and degrade in unexpected ways.
So let's say after you've soldered three separate wires together and you want to keep them apart, other than electrical tape to keep them apart, you'd say you'd be leery of keeping them apart with hot glue?
Yes, I would go for the electrical tape, and then if you really wanted to do the hot glue, then I'd smear the hot glue on the other side of the electrical tape. But since people have been using electrical tape for decades for electrical contacts, I would feel far safer than a random glue gun.
Okay, that was the question. Thanks, Roy.
Okey-doke. So let me drop for a second. I'll give you this story real quick, and then we'll move on to space. Sky watchers admiring November's full moon will also get to see another treat, a penumbral eclipse, when the moon passes through Earth's outer shadow on Monday, November 30th, according to NASA. The moon will be at its fullest for only a moment. On Monday, that happens at 4:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, but the moon will appear full for 3 days from Saturday night through Tuesday night, November 28th to December 1st. Meanwhile, sky gazers need to remember three times to catch the penumbra eclipse. It starts before the full moon at 2:32 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. It reaches its maximum at 4:42 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, when 83% of the moon will be covered with the Earth's faint shadow, and it ends at 6:53 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, Monday morning, according to timeanddate.com. Penumbral eclipses are different from total or partial eclipses. During a total lunar eclipse, Earth passes directly between the sun and moon, blocking the sun's light from reaching our natural satellite. In contrast, during partial eclipses, the moon passes through part of the Earth's inner dark shadow, known as the umbra. Finally, in a penumbral eclipse, the moon passes through part of the Earth's outer, fainter penumbral shadow, according to space.com, a life science sister site of the article I got. Unless you're a seasoned sky watcher, it may be challenging to see November's penumbral eclipse, which will be visible in North America, because the penumbral shadow will appear as a dim veil. The dimming of the moon during the eclipse will probably not be noticeable without some instrumentation, but for spacecraft at the moon, such as the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, the reduction in solar power will be noticeable, NASA wrote in a statement. November's full moon, known to many as the Beaver Moon, comes late in this month this year because October had two full moons. The second moon, a blue moon, was the first time in 76 years that a full moon was visible across the United States on Halloween. Other names for November's full moon include the cold moon, frost moon, winter moon, old moon, and the moon before Yule, and as well the child moon. The full moon will also be celebrated during Kartik Purnima as a Hindu, Sikh, and Jain cultural festival, celebrated differently for each culture. Kartika Dipam, a festival of lights observed by some Hindus, and Taza Deng, festival moon observed by Buddhists in Myanmar and formerly called Burma, and Ilpoya celebrated in Sri Lanka, NASA reported. Let me drop. The Beaver Moon is the last full moon before the winter solstice, the shortest day of sunlight in the northern hemisphere, which falls on December 21st this year. Other celestial sightings to look for in late November and early December include Jupiter and Saturn, which will appear to gradually shift closer to each other, appearing nearer than the apparent diameter of the moon from December 17th to 25th. NASA reported they will appear at their closest, about one-fifth the diameter of the moon, on December 21st, 2020. People with backyard telescopes should be able to see Jupiter's four bright moons, Ganymede, Callisto, Europa, and Io, and even Saturn's bright illuminated rings and Titan, its largest moon. Seeing Jupiter and Saturn so near each other should appear spectacular by telescope and with the naked eye, NASA said. For those who miss November's moon, they can always plan to see the last full moon of 2020, which will light up the sky at 10:28 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on December 29th. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GM. Okay, everyone, once again, want to thank everyone who participated tonight. Want to remind everyone that if you have any mailbag questions or topics or puzzles or you want me to ask Paul to take a look at something, just send them to mailbag@ac2gs.com. Link page to articles that I think you'll find interesting. I have some on the ionosphere and radio satellite devices. You can find that at roy.ac2gs.com. And always remember, Mike has his archive site at amateurradio.tv. And now let me call upon Paul, WS2N, with the Space Report.
AC2GS, WS2N, very good on all of that information for this evening, including the two planets, Saturn and Jupiter, coming closer together. I've been looking at that any clear night, you know, early evening, you go out there and you can see the two of them are very close together if you look to the southwest. And, you know, you go out a week later and you see they're even closer together and so on until you get to, like, the 22nd of December, like you were talking about, Roy. They'll be right on top of one another. And if you look off to the left, you know, if you look at those two planets, if you look at the off to the left, you'll see a red star, and that's Mars. You can see that quite clearly as well. So all the planets seem to be out. And theoretically, if you had a telescope powerful enough, you could look right between Jupiter and Saturn. Like I said, if the telescope was powerful enough to see Pluto, you would see Pluto. That's where it's located right now. And that's beyond that is where the Horizon spacecraft is traveling. But then again, if you look back at Mars, and you think about the distance between here and Mars, halfway, a little bit past halfway, that's where the next NASA rover is right now. It's past the halfway location. It's called Perseverance. They gave it a name, and that will land on Mars February 18th. And if China has their way, they're going to be able to land in roughly around the same time. They have an orbiter and a lander going there. And one other orbiting spacecraft that's due to orbit that planet as well in that same time frame, and that's called HOPE. Now, that's built by the United Arab Emirates. So a lot going on in the sky to think about when you're out there, you know, coming home from work or just going out to the store, and you look up around, you know, right after dusk, you can see all this stuff. Let me drop it. And two other sightings which will be very interesting will be not this Monday, but the following Monday. So I'll cover it again next week on the TechNet. There's going to be 2 days, Monday and Tuesday. Hopefully one of those nights or maybe both of those nights will be clear. And you'll be able to see the International Space Station going overhead. And, you know, one of the brightest passings that they have. I think one is negative 4.2 and the other one's in that same category. So that will be a very good pass. And we'll be, the one of them on Monday will be at 85 degrees above the horizon. So if you're staying in New York City or in Long Island, you look right up above your head at that point. It'll go from horizon to horizon right over your house. And that will be a good pass. I'll cover that next Sunday. So let me drop it. China, like I said, is really gung-ho lately with this Mars mission as well. But they now have a lunar mission that they launched last week. And it didn't land on the moon yet, but it will
right now, just I think a day or two ago, it went into orbit around the moon. Right now it's an eccentric orbit. They're going to lower that eccentric orbit down to around 100 miles above the surface. And then they do have a lander on that orbiter. Lander will separate from the orbiter, go down to the surface near the ocean of storms, land there. And then they have a drill that's going to drill into the surface of the moon and bring out the material and put it into the top part of the vehicle, which contains an ascent vehicle. And from there, that ascent vehicle will eventually take off from the moon, head back to the orbiter that's still going around the moon, supposedly dock with that. After that, the that orbiter has an engine on it, powerful enough to deorbit the moon and head back to Earth, and eventually bring a sample back to Earth. So that should be interesting. First time anybody has brought a sample back from the moon since the we did it many times with the Apollo mission, six different times. We brought collectively over 800 pounds of stuff back from the back from the moon. So if you add that up, it's like the weight of a grand piano. So we brought a lot of material back. Russia did bring material back as well, but they only managed to do a little bit, pounds worth from their lunar lander. So it kind of makes it'll be the third country to successfully bring from the moon back to Earth. Let's see how they do. The mission's called Chang 5, so they've had a series of missions going to the moon. They've had orbiters, had one actually deorbit the moon, come back to Earth to see if they could do a successful reentry. They had another one, Mars. Chang 3 that landed on the moon, on the near side of the moon. Chang 4 landed on the far side of the moon. It's got a rover on it called the U-2, and that is still successfully operating, and that's been quite successful. So they're trying to catch up. We're still way ahead technology-wise, space-wise, but we shouldn't look behind us because somebody's always chasing us. Any questions or comments before I move on? Okay, Falcon 9 will be launching a new version of a cargo vehicle called Dragon. They've had a series of different Dragons over the years. Initially, they had the Cargo Dragon, which was able to successfully bring up, I think they're up to, they went up to 20 different launches with the cargo vehicles to the space station to bring up each time, thousands, they started off like around 4,000, and they got to around 5, 6, 7,000 pounds of stuff every time they went up there. So they had a cargo vehicle that to berth with the space station, and berthing and docking. Berthing, they have 16 bolts that are electrically driven, and they pull one unit to the other, and they're able to eventually open up the doors, and they have very wide doors in the berthing system. I think 53 inches, comes out to around like a 53-inch diameter. So they're able to bring large items into the space station or out to deorbit. And then they came up now with the crew vehicle, the crew Dragon, which has successfully gone up to the space station twice now with a crew and one time without a crew. So they dock with the space station. That's an automatic docking system where they have these clips that come out, and they once they attach to the adapting plate, it pulls the two of them together in that fashion at the same time. It hooks up data cables. It hooks up power jumper cables where they can pick up power from the space station. The only difference is the diameter that you go through is a little smaller, a little over a meter, a little over 39 inches to go through. So you can't bring the biggest pieces, you know, biggest science pieces of equipment, things that you would normally bring on a berthing mission. But it's designed that way because, you know, they need to cut back on the space to have this automatic system that they use to pull together. Also, they could disconnect real fast with the 16-bolt berthing system. If there was an emergency and if it was a crew type vehicle, it takes hours to do all of that. With this, it takes a short period of time. They could be out like in 10 minutes if they had to get into the Soyuz spacecraft on a or the Dragon spacecraft. They could disconnect real quick. So they have that version, and now they have the crew cargo vehicle, the newest version. And it's a little different shape of the original one, but they'll be able to carry just as much stuff to the space station. The only difference is it will be a docking system instead of a berthing system. So they'll attach to the same pressure mating adapters that the crew vehicle connects to. And the only difference is there won't be anybody inside, but they'll be able to open it up and bring in material that way. They just won't be able to bring in a big science rack and things they used to. If they do need to bring stuff up like that, you know, any big stuff, that will depend on the Japanese cargo version, the H2, which has that capability, and eventually the Dream Chaser, which is still being built by Sierra Nevada Corporation, SNC. They'll have the capability as well to either, they'll be able to do both, they'll be able to either berth or dock. So that thing is going to be going up this week. I think liftoff, I wrote it down here somewhere, 11:39 a.m. So daytime launch on Saturday, this coming Saturday. I'd like to see that thing successfully get off the ground. A couple of days after that, they'll dock with the space station. Any questions or comments?
KC2PL, questions?
Okay, there was a little static in the beginning, but I missed it. I heard PL at the end.
Alpha Charlie 2, Papa Lima, questions?
Okay, I did hear PL. Okay, AC2PL. Go ahead, WS2I.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The question is not about the Falcon, although that's absolutely fascinating. You mentioned activities on the dark side of the moon, and I started thinking about it. So dark side of the moon, yeah, you can't see anything, but isn't the dark side of the moon exposed to... I mean, it must be exposed to the sun, just because we can't see it from here. It's whipping around the outside of the perihelion, and so it must be illuminated at some stage, right? So they can get power that way. Is that, am I missing something geometrically?
No, you're right. Yeah, of course. It's dark for us. We just don't see it once we send the spacecraft up there. You know what's good? If you ever go onto the Discover website, it's not spelled, you know, like Discover, but there's a NASA satellite located 1 million miles away from us, in between us and the sun, so it's there all the time, so it's just following an orbit around the sun just like we are. So anytime it's looking back at Earth, it can see the whole Earth. It also sees the moon, so it's really cool to see the moon moving in front of the Earth. You know, they have a bunch of, you know, it's not a video, but you know, a bunch of pictures of, you know, time lapse type of deal where you see the moon move right in front of the Earth. Of course, the moon is lit up like a Christmas tree, because it's getting all the light from the sun. at that point. And but that would be a new moon for Earth. You know, we'd be looking up, and you really want to see the moon. But when it's in the new moon stage for us, of course, then it's the dark side of the moon, what we call the dark side of the moon, the opposite side that we can't see is lit up by the sun. So yeah, you're 100% right. When it comes to putting telescopes up there and all, they were talking about telescopes. An actual telescope, which they're planning, by the way, they want to put a 300-foot diameter telescope there 10, 15, 20 years down the road. You know, it's a long-range plan that they'd like to do. Of course, it would only be working when it is dark, when it's on the opposite side of the Earth from the sun. Drop it. But I think what would be good would be, they were talking earlier on with the radio astronomy. That would be great because that would work just wonderfully when it's, when the antenna is in a dark location. When it's in daytime and it's looking toward the sun a little bit, you're going to get a lot of noise, radio noise from the sun. Might not be that good. Might work off to the side a little bit. Might still be daylight. Still use it. Once it gets all the way around the opposite side, it's actually dark on that side. A radio astronomy antenna would work great. I remember Carl Sagan writing about that many years ago. That would be one advantage of setting up a base or set up a scientific. Antenna like that on that would be wonderful. AT2PL, WS1.
WS10, AC2PL. Yeah, that really, I mean, it's, to not make a terrible pun, that's very illuminating because, seriously, I'm such a poor astronomer. I always thought the dark side of the moon was dark, and no, it's not. It's brightly illuminated. And if it let me just ask a quick question. If it had an Earth-like atmosphere density and a similar composition, what would the temperature be when it was facing the sun? Would it be similar to, say, a regular spring day here?
Well, yeah, if you had atmosphere and of course, that would change everything. But as it is, you have a 500-degree swing. So something in the shade on the moon is roughly 200, almost 250 degrees below zero. And above, 250 degrees above zero in the sun. That's what you have now. So put an atmosphere there, it wouldn't last, but if you could temporarily put an atmosphere there, it would be the exact same atmosphere as us. You could probably have the same temperatures. It's relative to the sun. The sun is the moon is a certain distance away from the Earth. I always say 250,000 miles. The sun is 400 times that distance from the Earth. And the moon too. So it's not much of a percentage wise. You're looking at one 400th of a difference. So you're not going to have much of a change. You would not have much of a change in temperature. Figure it this way: say the moon was the Earth, another Earth, with two Earths going around each other instead of the moon. There wouldn't be any difference between the two. Back to you. I forgot your first name.
Yeah, Roger Paul Alpha Charlie 2 Papa Lima. The name is Jeff, and thank you very much. It's it really illustrates what happens when you have a planet which is has sufficient gravity to maintain an atmosphere and how it changes things. Anyway, sorry to interrupt your regularly scheduled program. AC2PL back to
Great question, Jeff. And I'm a big fan of keeping our atmosphere. I'm a big fan of studying all the other planets, figure out what could possibly go wrong here, and study Mars and see what happened to them, and you study Venus and see what happened to them. Realize that, you know, we're kind of lucky here, but we could make things go bad really fast, and that seems to be the way it's going. In fact, a lot of scientists say we've got like 12 years left to straighten things out. I hope it's longer than that. the way they're going to fix things is not fast enough for my taste. So gotta worry about the grandkids, their grandkids. You know, hope they have a nice place to live like we have. Okay, here another topic I was gonna bring up is this thing is on its way back from an asteroid. It's the Hayabusa spacecraft dropping. Hayabusa 2. Well, that lets you know there was a Hayabusa 1 about 10 years ago that Japan sent out to an asteroid and came back, and they had very little bit, microscopic stuff. They thought they were going to be able to get more stuff back from that asteroid. But they had more problems with that mission than you could shake a stick at. But at least they got their descent vehicle back, and they did get some microscopic things to look at. Hayabusa 2 should have more stuff on it when it comes back. It went to a different asteroid, and naturally after 10 years, they got better at what they were doing. So it's been on this multi-year mission to go out to Ryugu. And it went up to the asteroid. It sent down a couple of little robotic pieces that left the mothership, bounced around on the asteroid, and they were able to capture some small amount of stuff that they put into a descent vehicle. And anyway, for last year, it left Ryukyu, and it's on the way back December 8th, which is coming up real quick. Again, I'll cover it next week. But on December 8th, it will re-enter Earth's atmosphere. And when I say it, I mean the descent vehicle. It's going to separate from the main Hayabusa 2 spacecraft. Now, this mission was all done by Japan. Launched on an H-2 a rocket years ago on a, you know, with a hydrogen and liquid oxygen vehicle, and now it's on the way back. Then it should land. They have it planned to land in a very desolate area around Australia, and hopefully that will be successful. Whatever they get back is not even going to compare to what we're going to get back on our Osiris-Rex. Well, I understand we have a lot of stuff that we collected from Bennu, another asteroid. But we'll have to wait until 2023 to find out if Osiris-Rex, the one that went out to Bennu that NASA sent out, will successfully re-enter our atmosphere. And our lander goes to a desert area in Utah. So it's an Army training area. That would be great if they're successful. So far, that really went well. But I hope the Japanese mission makes it back okay. I'll have to see. I got another week or so to find out the results. Yeah, how high a booster makes that. Now, we covered this during launch and on the way to Ryukyu and everything. Here on the net, and when I say we, I mean AC2GS. He was really on top of this mission, so I'm sure Roy is going to be happy to see what I consider his mission successfully return in a week or so. Any questions or comments? Okay. With that, let me just move on to Virgin Orbital. Virgin Orbital is one of the companies owned and operated by Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos owns and operates Amazon, of course. But they also own Blue Origin. Blue Origin is let me backtrack. I'm going to confuse myself. Covering too many companies at one time. Let me just cover Virgin Orbital for now. Blue Origin had ideas originally, but Virgin Orbital has really done the job on this particular rocket launch. It's called Launcher One, being built by Virgin Orbital, and that's owned by Richard Branson, billionaire. Richard Branson is the guy that runs Virgin Galactic, who's also making this little spaceship one where he's going to put 8 people into it, fly on a suborbital flight. It's not going to go into orbit, but you're going to get it to space and eventually come back down. He's got this whole system laid out. He's got two spaceships built, putting the one through the final test now. And he plans on being one of the first people to take a ride in this thing. Once it's operational. And he's operating out of New Mexico, a place called Spaceport America. But anyway, he's got the spin-off business, and it's called Virgin Orbital. Virgin Orbital is, he developed a satellite delivery program. What he does, he takes the satellite that he's built with, I think it's got four sections to it, and they're all solid boosters, and they're solid booster fuel, and then the final one is usually controlled by a liquid fuel system, which you're able to get more control out of it. Anyway, this vehicle, called Launcher One, attaches to the belly of 747. 747 that Virgin Airlines, they have all these planes. He had taken one of them, 747, and made a carrier out of it to carry this massive rocket up to 45,000 feet, where the airplane's flying. And he wants to drop this rocket, and then plane pulls away on a very sharp angle, like 45 degrees away, away from horizontal. And this solid fuel rocket takes off, and it's going to go into orbit. He's been developing it for quite a few years. He tried to do a launch back in May, I think it was. And it didn't work out. Everything separated. Rocket lit only for a few seconds, and then it shut itself down for some reason. But now he's going to run another, let's call it a test. That first one didn't even have a satellite in it. He just figured, well, maybe it won't work, and it didn't. And then he wouldn't be able to put an expensive satellite into the orbit. This one, he has a couple of satellites on board. So I guess they have a little bit more confidence in this particular launch. And this thing's supposed to take place... I believe it's December 18th or December 20th, one of those days, depending on the weather. It's done over the Pacific Ocean, which, the idea is to drive the cost of delivering small satellites to orbit. And so far, it's been done before. The Pegasus rocket, which has been... I think they had over 40 launches over the years. Presently being operated by Northrop Grumman. But I think they only had like one launch a couple of years ago. So they're pretty much coming to an end, I think. Especially if this one takes over. Northrop Grumman launches on a Lockheed Super Jumbo Jet. It's called the Lockheed L-1011. And L-1011 was, back in the day when they were building the 747, Lockheed, wanted to build these L-1011s. And this is the only one left flying, naturally. The 747's won out over time. Grumman still is utilizing this plane to carry the Pegasus to orbit. So that's been successful. They've done it. They've launched some scientific satellites, and they've done okay. But they say it's very expensive. It's not that cheap. But apparently, Richard Branson thinks he could drive the price down with his system. Good luck with that. I think it's going to be successful, and then we'll see. Yeah, that venture winds up. It's called the Launcher One program. He doesn't have a fancy name to it, but we'll see. Any questions? This is WS2N.
WS2N, AC2PL. Sorry, one more question.
Okay, Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, the, you know, we're talking about putting, sorry, this is about the previous transmission. We're talking about putting up a spacecraft and putting them in orbit around orbiting asteroids and what have you around the sun, and then bringing it back and planting it down within 100 square miles exactly where we think it's supposed to go. But then you read the news, and they say there's been this kind of chunk of rock identified that may or may not, with some probability, hit the Earth plus or minus, you know, several tens of thousands of miles. Why can't we sort out a little bit earlier, or at least get the news to report more accurately, how closely something is going to transit the Earth's orbit?
Yeah, well, you're talking about the near Earth orbit. The NEO is all the asteroids that come dangerously close to Earth every now and then, and why they can't get more accurate information on those. Well, they get better all the time. I think there's like 100,000 of them that they've got cataloged. Some of them they don't. And they know their orbits pretty exact. And the orbits also change over time due to coming close to, for instance, coming close to the moon or the Earth. Their next orbit will change a little bit more, you know. And hopefully it'll go, you know, further away instead of closer to Earth next time it comes around. It also changes from the amount of light that it hits. It's called some man, and it's an effect that where light that hits these things changes it slightly every so often. But when we bring our spacecraft back, you know, from the same location we dropped it, you know, that's different. We know exactly where it is. The spacecraft itself knows where it exactly is. It is in space. It has star trackers on board. It's a little like telescopes looking out, and it knows to look for the, you know, the brightest stars. It's got an actual map, computer map inside these spacecraft. So it knows exactly where it is, the orientation it is from these star maps that's in, you know, loaded in the computer and these little tiny telescopes that are looking at the, you know, the sun or the, you know, it even knows the brightness of each one, so it knows what it's looking at. It knows where Vega is, you know, and it knows where Sirius is, and therefore it knows where it is in space. And that's how they do their thruster maneuvers. They know how long they have to fire their thrusters. So you could pinpoint this thing to the exact location of when it's going to come back to Earth by using that system with the star trackers up until the point where they could tell you within usually the size of a football field where it's going to land on Earth when it comes back. Back to you, Jeff.
Oh, right. That makes a lot of sense. But the mere fact that they're, you know, well, assuming that there's some degree of error when you use a whatever optical system the device has to identify a pattern of stars, and then you know, you can imagine that it's down to a level of pixels and how far away is the thing, and that you're putting in the viewfinder, and I guess that's where the corrections come in. But it's not like our geolocation here. It probably has a much more error to it than we imagine, with it coming down in a very accurate location. But I would imagine that it tracks over time. They take many time points. Is that a correct assumption?
Oh yeah. I don't know how often they do it, but I guess it happens quite often. And all your deep space missions have these things. Ones that are flown to where Saturn, Cassini had it. Star Trek is the Galileo mission that went to Jupiter. The Ulysses mission that went into solar orbit, into a north pole, over the north pole, south pole of the sun. That was called Ulysses. You know, without these Star Trekkers, they'd be kind of dead in the water. You have another one that's presently in orbit around Jupiter called Juno, and same thing. So I guess, you know, they probably program the computers to, you know, do a check on its position quite often, especially when, you know, after, before, during, and after thruster firing. They also have gyros on board to detect their location in space, and they have modern day gyros too. They don't even have these spinning things on it like they did in the old ones. You know, they really come a long way with navigating from one location to the other. I remember Voyager. Let me drop it. You know, when they went past all their planets that they visited, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, Uranus, you know, they just kept on going. They wanted to make sure that every now and then the antenna would point exactly back to Earth. They more or less shut down their star tracking system because they're running low on power. They're running on a RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. And as the years and decades go by, Voyager, they lose power. I think they 3 or 4% electrical power they tend to lose from year to year. So they've shut things down, cameras, certain heaters that they don't need anymore. They keep the essential things working. But one of the things that they do with it is the center of the antenna. They've got a 12-foot dish that points back to Earth to communicate with. In the center of the dish is a hole, and on the other side of the hole is really a photometer, a light meter. And when that light gets the brightest, in other words, they're pointing to the sun. That's close enough. When you're out, four times the distance of Pluto, and if you could match the sun with your antenna, the Earth is very close to that orbit, so that's close enough, and they're able to set their transmitter and still communicate with Earth, even at those distances, without the star tracking. Back to you, Jeff. AC2PL WS2N, and the name here is Paul.
WS2N AC2PL. Yeah, that's amazing, and it reminds me of various other sighting devices that many of us may or may not have used. You'd want to use a very small pinhole when you're that far out. Just one more quick question. I know you're probably almost done here, but and I know this is a divergence as well. But what is the closest we've ever been able to get a device to the sun, and why is it really almost impossible to get in a very, very close orbit or crash trajectory to the sun, heading the opposite direction, obviously, from what we were previously talking about.
Okay, well, yeah. We've had a couple of missions getting relatively close to the sun. It was the Messenger mission. Messenger went to Mercury. We put that into orbit around Mercury. Now, that's very close. That's, what, 88 million miles, I think, from... I'm trying to think. How many miles? Mercury is... It's very close. I usually go by AUs, the astronomy, you know, the distance between the Earth and the Sun is 1 AU. And Mercury, I think, is... I know it's like less than 40 million miles from the Sun. And that's really close, like, considering we're about 100 million miles, 93 million miles. But gives you an idea. So the temperature on Mercury is, well, I think it's around 700 degrees. So it's way up there. So you need electronics that could survive that. Now, recently, a couple of years ago, we covered the launch of the Parker solar mission from Earth. It was launched on a Delta IV rocket, Delta IV Heavy. So you take, you know, three of NASA's biggest rockets and bolt them all together, and it's this relatively small, I think, 1,000-pound spacecraft called Parker at the top of it. Now, what do you need this big rocket for? You need it actually to slow it down to, you know, you don't want the orbit going too, you know, in orbit around the sun too fast, otherwise you'll never be able to decrease the orbit. So this big rocket was actually able to slow it down to the point where you could do that. Now it's, you know, it's in orbit around the sun. And every now and then it passes Venus, and Venus will act, you know, use the gravity assist to actually slow down the speed even more. And each year that goes by around the sun, it's getting closer and closer to the sun. The goal is to bring it to, I think it's 4 million miles from the sun, which is like, I mean, if Mercury is 40 million, it's like one-tenth of that distance, you know. And it's going to be cooking. I think they said temperatures around 1,500 will be the average temperature, you know, Fahrenheit. Now, to stop that heat from getting into the electronics, they use this carbon-carbon stuff. This material is basically, you know, thick carbon. It's around 4 inches thick. And they're using that as a real heat shield. Put that in the front of the spacecraft, the Parker spacecraft, and so we've gotten right now the last pass it might have been 20 million miles. They're working their way down as the years go on. I think it's going to take 7 years. I think it was launched 2 years ago, so probably another 5 years left before you get down to that. I think it's 4 million mile mark. You know, mark where they really want to get all the way down to that low altitude. So I'll have to check Wikipedia real quick to make sure my numbers are right, but I think it's 4 million. Back to you, Jeff.
I mean, it's the, you know, the funny science fiction books where they crash into a star are just nonsensical. It's it takes an enormous amount of effort just to... even approach a star, let alone just intentionally crash into it. I guess I'm correct. Anyway, AC2PL, thank you so much, Paul, for your indulgence. Back to Memphis.
Okay. And I think it's going to be something like 300,000 miles per hour or something. When you're getting in that low, it's really, really hauling. But it's elliptical, too. It's not a true circular orbit, so it gets close to the sun and then it comes further out. It actually cools down a little bit, so it's not under that heat all the time. but quite a bit. And they have all kinds of special cooling loops on there that try to keep the solar panels cool. It's they got light detectors where the spacecraft shifts a little bit one way or the other, because it could, because you have a lot of solar wind when you get in that close, and you know, if the orientation shifts, you don't want to, you know, to have the Parker spacecraft turn a little bit, because you know, and then you will cook the vehicle, so it has to be looking at the sun head on for the whole time when you're in that close. And then the European Space Agency launched something called the Solar Orbiter a couple months ago. And they're looking to get quite close to the sun as well. They also have another vehicle that they launched a couple of years ago that they plan on, called Columbo Pepe. They plan on orbiting Mercury as well, like we did. Our mission is over, but you know, this hasn't begun yet. They actually have two spacecraft attached to the old Columbo Pepe. European Space Agency has one that's going to, you know, orbit the sun very close until you get to, you know, near Mercury, and then, again, many, many passes, and then eventually it'll go into orbit around Mercury. And then attached to it is another spacecraft built by Japan, so that will separate from that one, and that will go into a much higher orbit. They'll be able to get two kinds of readings from Mercury, one from a lower orbit and one from a higher orbit. So, and that's on the way as well. But all of those vehicles all need to withstand these high temperatures. But the highest temperature one is the one NASA put out there, like I was saying before, is Parker. That's really amazing that that's going to be able to function under those extreme conditions. All right. Any other questions? If not, I'll move on. And one more quick topic. The Electron rocket built by Rocket Lab. I've covered Rocket Lab a lot here. That's a company that is trying to drive the cost of launching small, relatively small satellites in space. And, you know, they're 1,000-pound or 1,500-pound satellites, or a combination of maybe 10 satellites, each one weighing 100 pounds. But they've launched successfully 15 different times. They have a launch complex in New Zealand, off the North Island of New Zealand. The owner of the company, Peter Beck, is from New Zealand, but registered in the United States, so it's a United States company, or Rocket Lab, and they launched the Electron rocket. And the Electron rocket is innovative. It's all made out of carbon material. A lot of the work is 3D printed, you know, additive manufacturing, so 3D printing, including their engines. He calls them the Rutherford engines. Rutherford engines. The main difference between their engine and other people's engines is the turbo pumps. You need a turbo pump to pump all these fluids into the rocket engine, into the chamber. A tremendous amount of fluid has to flow, and you use these turbo pumps. And most companies use the exhaust or pre-burner to use the exhaust of that to spin up these turbos to operate the pumps, push the oxygen and liquid oxygen and liquid fuel into the rockets and into the engines. They have a different system. They, instead of using that, they use an electric motor for each engine. They have 9 engines on the bottom here, first stage, and 1 engine on the second stage. But they use an electric motor, and they use lithium-ion batteries, and massive batteries that are attached to these motors, and they spin like crazy, 100,000 RPMs, whatever it is, and it's been working, like I said, 15 flights, so it's a different system. And he built them to be expendable, an expendable launch vehicle. So you launch it, the satellite gets into space, the boost, you know, comes flying through the atmosphere, gets destroyed, and lands in the ocean, the Pacific Ocean. Well, now he's got the bright idea save these boosters, and a little different system than what SpaceX does. SpaceX will launch a rocket, booster will come down and land, vertical landing on a boat out at sea.